So really, for both of you, can I ask, I don't know who would like to go first, why did you choose law? Why law for you, Joanna?
Well, I almost sort of grew up being against law in a way, because both my mum and dad were lawyers, and I thought that was a terrible thing to do, and I thought that the only thing that was good about all that pink ribbon that you get was, you know, that you could use it to tie up your hair and do lots of craft work. So I was very against law, but my mum came to the law as a second career after a career in local government, and she started doing the Law Society, her degree, I think, at East London Polytechnic in the evenings when I was about 10 years old. And I used to, for childcare purposes, I used to have to go and sit in the lectures and sit at the back doing my colouring in. So I kind of felt sort of saturated in it, and I thought it was a terribly boring thing to do. And I was much more interested in campaigning. So as a student, I studied classics, and I did lots of campaign work. I was involved in women's rights, Amnesty International. I set up a big national group about Burma, to look at human rights in Burma. And I very quickly learned, actually, doing that work, that it wasn't enough just to sort of tell people what you think they should be doing, and sometimes you needed the law to make them do things. And so that's really sort of slightly inspired by my mum, but also thinking that being a campaigner wasn't going to get you what you wanted, I decided to go into law, but very much with the point of view of doing both. Yes.
So I suppose we've got some similarities, although I'm not from a family of lawyers, very far from it. So I'm from a family which is sometimes described as being preachers and teachers. So a lot of priests, a lot of teachers. And I didn't actually have a background of people who had been in law. So the reason I came to law was, it sounds very cheesy, but I felt I wanted to do something that made a difference. And I gradually came to the position of thinking that law was a tool you could use to fight injustice and help the vulnerable. So if I wasn't a human rights lawyer, I wouldn't be a commercial lawyer. I would probably be an activist or something else. So I'm definitely not one of those people who thought I'm going to do law to be a lawyer and then thought about the area afterwards. I very much knew I wanted to do something around social justice and human rights, and law was one of the options. And continuing on the slightly cheesy theme, many of you will have seen the very sad news about Judith Kerr in the last few weeks. And I'm sure we all have one of those light bulb moments where you just read something at a particular time in your life that really speaks to you. And When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit was one of those books which I just read and just thought, this is outrageous and I feel I need to do something, and felt very inspired by it. So there are a whole series of these books in my life which have done that, and that was one of them. And then Helena Kennedy's book, the amazing book Eve Was Framed, was just one of those books which I happened to read in the early 90s. Yeah. And it suddenly makes you think differently about what the law can and should do. And it's such a privilege to have read that as a slightly nerdy teenager, and to then end up years later with her as your colleague and working on cases and causes together. And that's one of the real privileges about this job, isn't it? That you know, work with amazing people women, like Laura, work with many amazing women. And I do sometimes pinch myself and think I'd like to write to my 16-year-old self or my 8-year-old self and say, you can, those feelings you had when you read these books and thought you'd like to make a change, you can do it. So I suppose that's where I came into law. I came at it in that way. I should say, anyone who knew me growing up in Dublin is probably not particularly surprised that I've gone into something which involves arguing for a living. So, yeah, some people might have a slightly less kind take on the route.
Yeah, I think, yeah, my mum used to call me last word as a child. similar.
Yeah.
So I've obviously been doing a lot of work on Helena Normanton, and the idea is to inspire future generations of young women to use her as a model of resilience, for example, because she's this great role model. Who are the women who inspired you?
Well, I mean, definitely my mum inspired me, and my great great-grandmother, I was really privileged to know her. So she lived till she was 104. So we had a time in our family where there were all five generations. She came over in the 19th century from Russia, escaping various awful things that were happening to Jewish people in those times, and came and sort of worked in Soho, and was an incredibly strong, forceful, argumentative woman. So, who drank whiskey every day, and whose favourite food was bread and butter, both of which are similarities of myself now. but there are, I think, as Keelan's already said, there are some really incredible women that we're really privileged to work with now. And I'll talk about it a bit later, but actually some really inspiring women now, not least, I think, Lady Hale, who were in my capacity as chair of Legal Action Group, we're in the process of developing a children's storybook about her life and works, but incredible, incredible woman, not just the first woman to go to the House of Lords, now Supreme Court, first woman to be president, first female law commissioner, one of the first women in the Court of Appeal, but what a lovely person. And as a mother of two children, you know, being able to point to a woman who is a role model, who is incredibly intelligent but also incredibly kind, and has managed to succeed without being mean or acting like a man, is, I think, probably one of the best achievements you can possibly have.
So on the Lady Hale point, borrowing from Supreme Court advocacy, I would probably say I follow. Very much agree with you. And I think similarly to Laura, there's probably a range of women in different ways and at different times. So, you know, there's some people like the Judith Kerr, Helena Kennedy, who inspire you without knowing it, where you just happen to read something at a particular point and it speaks to you and it inspires you to do something, even if they're unaware of it. So there's women like that. There's also some women who I saw taking these quite high-profile cases just at some key points, which were very inspiring. So seeing, you know, for example, Mac Libel, you know, at a particular time, and seeing this was such a brave challenge to take, and fighting it in the way that they did, just happened to speak to me at that particular time. But I also think with inspiration, a lot of it is about inspiration on a daily basis, because, being completely frank, the work we do is very grueling in many ways. So, you know, lots of people think when you see something like the result in the Hillsborough inquest that this must be the best job in the world. And I do think working in human rights law, the ups are amazing. And I can't imagine someone who works in other areas of law gets anything like, you know, the high you get when you see clients getting, after three decades of injustice, the right result and feeling finally some sense of accountability. But the flip side of that is that the downs are absolutely horrific. And on a day when you lose in court, it's so horrendous. And, you know, I always think, I was looking at the Times Lawyer of the Week, which always has a standard question, which is, what was your worst day in court? And most people who answer that say something like, well, I went into court and I had toilet paper stuck to my shoe. It was terribly embarrassing. Everyone was laughing at me. And the answers are generally about them. And I think in our area of work, your worst days in court are when you get the wrong result for your clients. You know, they're when you get a result like I did in a case about 10, 12 years ago, where she'd been the victim of rape as a result of gang violence, and a social worker just hadn't believed her. And we went to court to challenge the assessment the social worker had done. And the court said, well, it's judicial review, very hands-off approach to assessment. We can't see that the social worker got it flagrantly wrong. And we ultimately got a good result for her. But the day when we lost that case at first instance was horrific. And it's horrific because of what it does to your client, what it does to the people you're working with. So for me, in terms of inspiration, some of the people who inspire me most and keep you going when times are tough, and they're often tough, are our clients. And I think Laura and I are both privileged enough to have many amazing women and girls who we act for, who are incredible. So, you know, the women who brought the benefit cap challenge, the two benefit cap challenges, you know, our women from very marginalised communities, couldn't be more vulnerable, very, very low income, and incredibly difficult for them to put their head above the parapet and bring a test case to try to make things better for women in their cohort. So people like that are incredible. Or many of the female journalists I work with who face awful abuse on a daily basis just for doing their job. They're incredible. Mm. So I think as well as the kind of big names, there's many of those everyday names. And also, cheesy again, but my mum, probably echo you, Laura, as well. My mum, not a lawyer, but she also had two careers, was a midwife for a long time. She'd actually wanted to do medicine, and at the time in Ireland, medicine was something that men did, wasn't something that women did. Women did arts degrees if you went to university, so she'd done a kind of archaeology and geography degree and got out of it as quickly as she could and then went to do nursing, which was the closest thing she could find to what she really wanted to do, and then she became a midwife. And then later, having worked with some very vulnerable communities, she decided she actually wanted to go back and retrain with me as a babe in arms as a primary school teacher and work in one of the most deprived schools in the country in an area called Darndale. And I saw her doing that. So although it wasn't law, it was her using her skills and being adaptable to try to help some vulnerable people. So my mum too. Cheesy answer. Yeah.
And I think also just following from what Keelan says there about our clients, and also sometimes it's the cases that never get to court because you just can't, for whatever reason, be it legal aid blocks or be it because there just isn't a challengeable cause, because you know you're going to get something like you described. And there's a young woman that I've worked for many years who I just think is just so incredible and so resilient. And at one point, you know, she after she went through the most horrific start in life, being neglected and abused, and her first memory being policemen in her home while she was still in her cot. You know, that was her first memory, and working her way through the prison system, coming out. And at one point I went to visit her, and she had four children under the age of four, and she was just coping so incredibly well, and she was just so resilient, and none of it gets recognised. And I just think sometimes you know, sometimes it's even cases that you can't get off the ground, but you just see the most incredible resilience and resolve.
And as well as the cases that don't get off the ground, there's so many women who are anonymous. So in the field of sexual violence, for example, or in the field of children's rights, many of our clients, you'll only know them, even if they did take a case, through their initials in the court reports, so that they're not known. So if you look, for example, at some of the very brave women who've taken challenges to the European Court of Human Rights and domestically here, about abortion restrictions in Northern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland, you know, many of them are women who are just known as A, B, C, X, Y, Z, the X case. And I saw someone refer to it recently as a sad alphabet of women. And behind all of those, many of those are our clients. And I know sometimes when we speak, you've got to remember, because you remember the name of your client, you've got to remember this key case that you were involved in, and you've got to remember it's actually called S and Croydon, or whatever called, because you don't know the person as S, you know the person by their real name. But there's many of those people behind those acronyms, and I think one of the disadvantages of the acronyms is that people often forget the real human story, because it's so difficult to tell a story when it's faceless and nameless. And one of the challenges we've had for a number of years in some areas is it's very hard to tell a story and to get the press to have an interest in a story when it's anonymous. So with the campaign we did a few years ago, trying to tell positive stories about the Human Rights Act, the Act for the Act campaign, you know, we had some really brave people who came forward and who were willing to have their faces plastered all over buses and all over posters on the tube, you know, to say, here's my story about what happened to me. But the one story that was very difficult to tell there were stories like the War Boys women, any stories to do with sexual violence, or any stories to do with benefit cuts for people who've got particular sexual violence backgrounds or domestic violence, because their names, they're faceless and they're nameless. And it makes it very hard to get people interested in those stories. Oh, that reminds me of one thing. I'm so sorry. You might only get through two questions. but I should say, someone who I should have on this list, who I didn't think of until just now, is there's some really amazing journalists who do try to tell the stories of those faceless orphan women in stories that are really important and in ways which are compelling to the reader and which then get attention.
And I think Frances Ryan, who's a superb journalist, and Amelia Gentleman have done a lot for actually putting on the radar topics, which it's quite hard to put on the radar as a journalist because you've got to work quite hard to tell a story when you don't have a face and a human interest story. Mm. You've got to tell the human interest story in a way which is anonymous. And they've both done really quite incredible work, actually, telling many of these stories and getting around the fact that the person at the heart of it is called X or Y or A or B.
Mm. So both of you are obviously at the top of your game, aren't you? You are leading law at Howard Lee, you're a QC. But everybody in this room will be aware of the statistics that there are a lot of women who start out in law, but by the time that they're towards the end of their profession, the end of their career, that they have gone, they've disappeared, and there are very few women who were in, for example, partners of solicitors' firms or QCs. Mm. So, I suppose, how have you both got there, and what do you say about those shocking statistics?
Well, in terms of the statistics, I think they absolutely are shocking, and there is no excuse for them. I founded a group called the Young Legal Aid Lawyers when I was a trainee, and part of that was to really try and support young people who wanted to go into publicly funded areas of work. And guess what? It was all women. And guess what? 15 years on, what I've seen is, even though there are some amazing women that have grown up through Young Legal Aid Lawyers and it's become a network of kindred spirits, but so many of them have had to relinquish their dreams, and the same old story of having to sort of stop and be thwarted. Actually, I think at this point I might just read a little bit from Baroness Hale's judgment in the St Helens Dinner Ladies case, which was the equal pay case back in, when was it now? It was back in 2007, and she just says, "Women workers have suffered injustice in the labour market for centuries. This is not only because they tend to have more interrupted working lives than men, they have been paid less than men for doing the same work. They have been segregated into women's work, which is paid less than men's, simply because it is women's work." And then she goes on to talk about the gender pay gap as it was then, which actually isn't dissimilar to what it is now. And actually, one of the issues is in the field that we work in, where most lawyers that joined Young Legal Aid Lawyers, like Gillian and I, they did it because they were committed to social justice, and that's why they wanted to become lawyers. And the reality is, and I don't think we have the data to back this up, but certainly my view, and I don't know what Gillian thinks, is that a lot of the legal work that women do tends to be on the more caring side. So lots of legal aid lawyers, not all of them, are women. And that is an industry that is struggling, has been cut more than almost any other industry, and is really hard for small firms to survive and then to do what they need to do to promote women and support them through having families. And many women, I think probably if we were to get the Law Society to give us the demographics of legal aid lawyers, we would find that it's disproportionately women. And possibly women of colour too, actually. And I think intersectionality, we can talk about that later, something Keila and I have talked about. So I think there is still a huge problem. And I think the nature of the kinds of work, legal law that women do, actually means that the inequality is perpetuated. How did I come up? Was your original question. I'm not sure I am quite at the top of my game, but it's very nice of you to say so. But
it's typical female modesty.
I just slogged it out, I guess. I was very lucky. When I was studying part time, I saw a job advertised in the Guardian for a personal assistant for a man called Edward Fitzgerald. I went along to an interview.
You might have heard of him.
which was a very strange interview. It seemed there was a sex workers' protest in Soho that day, and so I was very late. sort of trying to weave my way through the sex workers protest, arrived late and explained the reasons why, which he was very accommodating about. And I was privileged then actually to spend 3 years, as I did my part-time study, working as his assistant and researcher, and I got to sit through lots of key cases. And I don't think there's be a day in my legal practice where I don't use something that I learned working with Ed to inform a decision I make or a strategic decision I take. And that was an incredible experience for me. But I really struggled to get a training contract, and I went and joined a high street firm where I was working in police stations till 1-2 in the morning, and then up at 6-7 preparing non-molestation injunctions in the county court, where I experienced all sorts of difficulties and bullying, and even, you know, remember one time having to be escorted from the Willesden County Court by the court bailiff back to my office because the respondent in non-molestation injunction had it in for me, you know, and eventually managed to see an opportunity at the Howard League where I thought actually I could square that circle of campaigning and law and go back to, and something I learnt working with Ed was it probably wasn't enough just to be a lawyer. If you wanted to make people do what you wanted to do, you needed to win hearts and minds as well as cases, and that's why I ended up joining the Howard League, and I've stayed there ever since. But it's not been particularly easy, and after I was employed there as a solicitor, and when I was pregnant with my second child, I realised actually it just wasn't compatible, and there was no way I could continue being an employed solicitor in an NGO doing a mixture of policy campaign and direct legal work and see both the children that I was going to have. And so I actually then had to take a slight sort of detour, and I became a consultant solicitor, and I became a consultant both for the Howard League, they wanted to keep up that connection, and in private practice, and which meant after my second child, you know, I was back working within days as a consultant lawyer, but I needed that flexibility in order to do all the things I wanted to do as a mum and as a lawyer. And it was only back in 2016 that I went back into employment at the Howard League, and I'm still also a consultant one day a week because so as not to ditch all the clients that I started working for then. So it's another example, I guess, of having to twist and turn and weave about to accommodate all the needs of being a working mum and doing what you want to do.
I thought it was interesting that Laura said I was lucky. I think those of you who know Laura's work would think pretty tremendous amount of talent there rather than luck. And I wouldn't normally quote Margaret Thatcher, but let me do it for a moment. So, Margaret Thatcher once said, I wasn't lucky, I deserved it. And I do think, it happens to men too, that I do think women in particular quite often have a kind of sense of imposter syndrome and a sense of there must have been some mistake and didn't you mean this for someone else? You know, and I had that when I got my letter about, you know, taking QC. I had to read it quite a few times to make, had they made a mistake? What had happened? Was it an accident? So I do think there's a good point about women in particular tending to think that it's luck. But actually, I think for all of us, there's probably an element of luck. But women might be less likely to, women might be more likely to acknowledge the luck than maybe some others would. And I do know plenty of men who also have a strong dose of imposter syndrome and speak in that way, but I think particularly the successful women I know quite often apologise for their place in the world, or apologise, you know, or suggest that there's luck or it's other people, and they're very willing to thank other people. And I think we should do that, but I do also think we should celebrate actually talent, which results in people coming to where they are. So a couple of things. I mean, I think if you're female, and particularly if you're female and you're slightly outside the environment anyway, so you already feel a little like an outsider. There's plenty of things which tell you are an outsider, and I get that quite a lot. So a really good example, I think, is, as many of you will have seen, not those of you who are listening, my name is quite odd, has rather a large collection of silent vowels
and silent consonants. So it's a classic Irish name with multiple letters that you don't pronounce. So C-A-O-I-L-F-H-I-O-N-N. Just pronounce Keelan, but that's how you spell it. And it's a very unusual name, and in many ways
don't
here...
Don't forget the QC bit.
Of course. Yeah. But in many ways here, that's gender neutral. When people see it written down, they don't know if you're a man or woman. And I have absolutely noticed in the 2.5 years of becoming a Silk, people assume I'm a man a lot more. So I've gone to multiple events where when you walk in, they say, you know, I give the name and they say, well, when is Mr. Gallagher arriving? I think, this is me, you know, woman who's relatively young. But they clearly expect something quite different to what they're getting. And I didn't have that as much. I've lived in the UK since 2001. So I had quite a long time before I was a QC. And I still had some confusion and the odd experience where someone might think you're a man rather than a woman. It absolutely happens to me a lot more now that I'm Silk. And that's quite interesting because you think, when you think about imposter syndrome in women, a large part of it is because the world tells you you should feel like an imposter. Mm-hmm. The world says, we were expecting a white man in his 60s and now you've walked in with this Dublin accent and you're female and it's a surprise. So I did have an event a number of years ago where I turned up as a keynote speaker wearing something rather like this, straight from court, so a white top, black suit, and someone else who was speaking saw me and assumed I was staff, handed me their coat to put into the cloakroom. So, almost instantly you think, I should have said this, I should have said that, and of course I didn't. I actually took his coat. I put it into the cloakroom, but then I turned up on the panel rather smugly and looked at him, and he did look very embarrassed, but clearly I should have had a better comeback when it happened. But, you know, I think we get a lot of things where the world tells us it's a surprise you're here. Mm. So it's not surprising that you then have amazing women like Laura using words like look. A couple of really quick things, because you asked about the statistics as well, and you asked how we got here. So on how we got here, I knew I wanted to do human rights law, came from a background in Ireland. I did my degree originally and my barrister training in Ireland and loved it. But it's more common if you're a barrister in Ireland to be a jack of all trades and to do a bit of everything. And I was very keen on specialising. And there's only a small number of places in the world where you can be privileged enough to specialise in this area of work. And London is one of them. So I had a few places in my sights. Then I happened to see a job that was advertised at Liberty. And I had that slight stalker tendency in relation to Liberty. And Liberty advertised a job which I thought looked fantastic. And I came over and worked with John Wadham for a while on the right to privacy, and as a qualified European lawyer here, I promised I wouldn't think about Brexit during this session. So that's the only thing I'll say that touches on Brexit in any way. So as a qualified European lawyer, I came over here, felt very welcomed, and worked at Liberty, and then I transferred to the bar a little bit later, having done some cases essentially in-house at Liberty in the European Court of Human Rights. And then in terms of how I moved to becoming a Silk, that's thanks to another really amazing woman who probably doesn't know that she had this impact, slightly similar to the Judith Kerr, Helena Kennedy reading books in your bedroom. So when I was pregnant with my second child, I've got three kids, when I was pregnant with my second child, I was doing the 7/7 London bombings inquest. And I look back at it now and I can't quite understand how I did it, because I had a very young child who was just starting to have nightmares and not sleep very well. My partner was working as an academic out of London, so was away for most of the week, heavily pregnant, and obviously with these incredible clients and dealing with really awful evidence every day, really grim evidence every day, and people who were really traumatised and damaged by what they'd seen or what they'd experienced. So I had one of those timetables which, when you look back at it, you think, how did I do that? You know, so got up every morning at 6, I worked from 6 until 7, my daughter got up at 7, I had an hour of time completely with my daughter, not doing anything else from 7 till 8. I then had someone who came to help at 8 while I went into court, did the day. Whenever there was any issue about sitting late, I did what many women advocates do, sat there thinking, oh my God, childcare, how will I manage this? Tried to sort it out under the table, sending various emails, not wanting to be the only woman in court who's an advocate saying, I can't do that. So it was this very stressful existence and doing this and having the privilege of working with these incredible clients on this horrific case that was so important to them. And I was pregnant the whole way through. You know, sometimes you hear those studies about how some babies respond to the music from Coronation Street or something, because they've heard it a lot in utero. I did think, this baby is probably going to respond to Lady Justice Hallett's voice. So it's the only thing he's actually heard. But when I was on maternity leave with him and really having a crisis of confidence about whether I could return to work, which many women do after having a second child in particular, returning to the bar after a second child is very difficult. Mm. I got a letter out of the blue from Lady Justice Hallett saying, have you considered applying for Silk? You should consider it. And it was really early. And one of those letters which I read while I was covered in baby vomit and various things, it was such an incredible thing to do. I don't even think I replied to her, because you're in that fog of, you know, baby mess and no sleep. But that was one of those things which was, it was such a wonderful thing to do, and she is absolutely the reason why I put the application in. Not then, quite a few years later, but she was very much in my mind when I did it, and what a wonderful thing to do.
And I think actually that's such an inspiring story, Keelan. I remember you talking about that at when we had your Silks party, which was brilliant, and there were just so many people there, just so happy for ye, because it is, you know, so young to get Silk, regardless of your gender. But you know, I think that point, and I think Lady Hale says, it's very wicked actually not to encourage women. And support women, and as much as, you know, even tonight I've demonstrated this sort of imposter type syndrome thing that you've picked up on as maybe could be a psychotherapist next. but you know, I think it is, you know, I have lots of the women that I supervise, and mainly it is women, in fact, entirely women that I supervise at the moment in both the Howard League and my other practice. You know, I regularly have to stop them sending emails that start with apologies.
Yeah.
Because there's no need quite often, but it's the natural tendency, and I'm quite protective of that with the people that I'm supervising now, and in terms of encouraging them to feel confident and proud of what they're doing. But you know, I think there is a real tendency for.
It's like there can sometimes be a tendency to have a linguistic manspreading, if I can put it that way.
Yep.
Like the equivalent of the person who takes up lots of space
yes.
on the tube.
Yep.
And I appreciate plenty of women do that with bags and various things. But there is a thing, and it's not purely gender, but I think there is a gender link to it about that language, which is, I'm sorry, I'm taking up space.
Yeah.
In your world, in your inbox,
yeah.
you know, apologies, I'm sorry, even when it's something quite reasonable.
Yeah.
And there was that study a few years ago about women in the US Supreme Court, as justices in the US Supreme Court, and it found, after analysing years of data, that women Supreme Court justices in the US are far more likely to get interrupted than their male colleagues. Mm. They're more likely to get interrupted by their judicial colleagues, and they're more likely to get interrupted by the advocates. And they tried to check it against seniority, and they found that gender was actually a really critical issue. But they found that over a period of time, a lot of the women judges altered their language, because they found that one of the reasons why that tended to happen was some of the women judges would interrupt advocates or ask advocates questions which were open questions, which lent themselves more to someone jumping in, and actually over time they found some of them adjusted their language to be more assertive and more kind of typically male in their language, which is quite depressing in many ways. But having read that, I see that so often. I'd love if someone did a study like that on the Supreme Court here, because I'm sure it's right.
I'm sure it's right, but I'm sure it also doesn't have to be that way. And I think one of the things, my own daughter is quite assertive, and I was kind of, we were recently at a book festival at Hay & Wye, and we went to see a really good author called Frank Cottrell Boyce, who writes brilliant children's books, and we went to see it, and it was a great thing. And she said to me, Mum, you know, his books are really good, but there's never any girls that are the main characters. And I said, yeah, that's a good point. That's not very good, is it? And then we went for the book signing, and without any prompting, she just went up to him and said, well, why don't you have any girls as main characters?
That's great.
You know, and I was just sort of sitting there thinking, ooh, how's he going to react? And he looked at her, and she put her name down for her book signing. He said, okay, right, well, I will make the next book I write with a main character called Roxy. Well, I don't know if he will, but I was really bowled over by the fact that she just had, without any kind of anxiety about her at all. It was the most natural thing in the world for her to go up to this famous guy and challenge him. And it wasn't, she wasn't doing it in an aggressive way or in a manny way or a boy way, but she was just pointing it out and saying it like it is. And I hope that it doesn't have to be. I hope he does. Otherwise, I'll be gutted.
That's just from my view. There's an amazing children's author called Catherine Rundell. I heard her speak at something a few years ago, which was one of those classic events where there were lots of children with their hands up to speak. Mm. And then the first person who gets asked to speak is actually an adult. And then lots of the children freeze. But the adult said to Catherine Rundell the opposite point. You know, why do you have so many female characters in your books? Because it puts boys off reading. And you could almost see steam coming out of her ears, you know. And she was wonderful, you know, and she did just respond by saying there's this assumption that you can write Harry Potter with a boy at the heart of it, and that'll be read by boys and girls. But when you've got a book, a children's book with a girl at the heart of it, boys won't read it. And it's just not correct, you know. And she was really fantastic, actually. And she was also talking about adults making that self-reinforcing. And, you know, nowhere could it have been more obvious than when the question had been asked by a parent, not by a child.
Yeah.
So really interesting. Can I say one thing about statistics? Because you asked about that earlier, and because this has been really interesting, we keep meandering off in various ways. But I got a letter when I took Silk from a woman called Eleanor Platt QC, who took Silk in 1982. And I've now discovered that she writes to every female Silk every year with a letter that starts, "Dear female QC," and is then followed by a list of every single female QC, alive or dead, who's ever been appointed. And I just had a look. That's what I was, why I was looking at my phone, just to see where I was. So she had, so in her letter she said, "I attached to this email, as well as this letter of congratulation, a list, now quite long, of all female Silks ever. And when you look at that, I think it makes for very sobering reading. So it commences with the list of women who've died, including Helena Normanton, who you spoke about earlier, Judith, and Rose Holbron, first women Silks in 1949. Helena Kennedy, who we referred to earlier, Silk in 1991, shockingly, was only number 44 ever in 1991. The numbers don't even hit 200 until 2008, and they're climbing. But still, I was appointed in 2017. I was still only number 397 ever. And when I got that letter and checked, I saw 397 ever, under 400 ever at that time, of women who'd been appointed Silk, including women who died. And I had a look on the Bar Council statistics about the number of male Silks in practice at that time, and it was over 1,600. You just think, you know, number of male Silks in practice then, snapshot, 2017, completely dwarfs the number of women ever who've been appointed. So those statistics are really shocking. And one of the things that really frustrates me about those statistics is when we've had equal entry to the profession for barristers and solicitors for such a long period of time, and we still have statistics like this, and we still have statistics about how few women are partners in city law firms and so on, and then we have the combination of cuts to legal aid in some of the areas where you actually have much better female representation, it makes me really anxious about what we're going to do about other challenges like class, for example. You know, so when it comes to other topics where you don't have anything like equivalent or proportionate entry, when you've had proportionate entry for decades and we still have these terrible numbers at the end that come out of the other end of the sausage machine, makes me very worried about what we can do with some of the other challenges.
So that leads us nicely on to what do you both think are the key challenges for equality in the professions now?
I still think, and it really leads on from what we're just talking about, there's still a problem, there's still a cultural problem. I think there, I mean, we can't deny, obviously, as an access to justice campaigner for many years, we cannot deny that certainly for those of us who practice in social welfare law and social justice law, that the austerity, legal aid cuts, a kind of encroaching repugnance, if you like, about challenges to the state, you know, from the state. These are all real, real problems. But I do also think that there is a huge cultural problem of not recognising the need to make adjustments so that women can flourish, and women, not just any women, because there is this issue that we've talked, you've said that word, class. It's really important, isn't it? And in you know, young legal aid lawyers have done a lot of work on social mobility. We did a social mobility report when I was chair, and they've done a follow-up one. And the reality is that, you know, I'm still, in fact, just this week there was a blog post, it's a site called View from the Gravy Train, of a young woman who said she can't afford to stop becoming a paralegal and move on to get a training contract because she can't afford to get a training contract where she thinks she'll only earn £16,500. And so, you know, we've got a situation where the opportunities, and it cuts across the NGO world and everything, the opportunities you need to get under your belt in order to get a leg up are ones that are not available to people who do not come from privileged backgrounds, and that's a huge issue. I also think there's still a huge problem, I think, particularly at the current time. We are living in a deeply divided and racist society, so I think for women of other backgrounds it's even more difficult, and I think that's something that we have to challenge. And it feels that politically, at any rate, there is no desire really to challenge that, so I think those are huge challenges for women today.
So I agree very much on the cultural point, and actually colleague who's a very brilliant employment lawyer who happens to be a black woman, very senior, says that even still, whenever she turns up in an employment court and she walks through the door, she knows that she will be taken as if she's a client. And it happens to her all the time. And then she said it becomes circular because as she walks through the door, she thinks, even though she's dressed up and she's got her wheelie bag, she can feel it coming, and then it affects how she carries herself. And there's so much of that. I think if people are expecting you to be a certain thing, you don't fill the space. So conversely, the people who are, were always expected to be successes and have this huge privileged background, you know, don't have that. They don't have that same doubt, and they're not as affected. When someone asks you something which is essentially a why are you here question, the take my coat, why don't you? Yeah. Or like another colleague of mine who's a female silk who's quite diminutive, had an experience within her first week as a silk where she went into the front row and the clerk came over and said, that's actually for the silk steer. You know? And you know, but there's so many of these stories if you speak to women. And when you speak to women of colour or women who are diminutive or women who are particularly young for their role, there's just the world expecting you shouldn't be here. And when you get those messages, I think not only does it undermine you, I think sometimes it can be quite circular because you might stumble over your words more, you might be more nervous, you might not perform at your best because all these things are telling you you're not your best and you shouldn't be here. Why are you playing with all these other people who deserve their spots?
But it's also so exhausting, isn't it? Yeah. I'm just thinking of an example where a parole board member said to me, oh, I see you're down as doctor. Should I call you doctor? And I was sort of saying, oh, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a proper doctor. And he said, oh, OK, I'll call you miss. I just thought, oh. You know, but actually, maybe, you know, I should have just...
That's him calling now, Lauren.
Is that him calling?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yes, you know, and actually, the point is, it would have been, you know, an effort and slightly exhausting to say, well, yeah, I'm a doctor, and you know, I worked for 5 years to get that doctorate, and say yes, please. But it's just that you're put in that position. Yeah. I wouldn't ask a doctor whether they want to be called doctor or not. I just call them doctor. But
well, there's something very funny about that, isn't there? You know, when you get there has for a very long time been that assumption that. If you're a female advocate, the judgment calls you miss. And if you're a female judge, you're called Mrs.
Yeah.
And our first judge who disagreed with that and decided, High Court judge, and decided she wanted to be Ms. Was about 2 years ago. I mean, really recent. And actually, I put those into the typographical corrections. You know, I say, whenever it comes, I say, you know, I'm not Miss. I do sometimes think, petulantly, in the back of my head, I don't say this. You know, why aren't you calling my opponent master?
Yeah.
But actually, something Lady Hale did within a few weeks of her starting at the Supreme Court is any of us who were in the Supreme Court in the weeks and months afterwards doing a case, we got an email quite early on saying, and it didn't say it came from her, but the cultural change definitely came when she started as the president. We got a letter saying, just so you're aware, When we're doing the draft judgment, we're going to assume that women want to be addressed as Ms., MS. Mm. And if you disagree with that and you want to be a Miss or a Mrs., let us know. We're assuming men are Mr., we're assuming women are Ms., let us know otherwise. And that, I know it sounds very small, but as someone who spent many years thinking, this judge already dislikes me, I'm now going to have to write my thank you for your draft judgment. I have some typographical errors. Don't call me Miss. It was actually quite nice. And it sounds like a small thing, but Miss is diminutive.
It is.
And it's something which it's diminutive, and the way it's used, particularly when it's not used by female judges, when they're called Mrs., regardless of their marital status or their background, there's something quite unpleasant about it. And you don't have that structuring or status distinction when you're a male advocate or a male judge. And it was quite nice. So it's a small but important cultural shift. I suppose the other thing to mention on your question about challenges is I've written down sticky floor. And that's because I think a lot of the time you think about the glass ceiling for women and things which you hit up towards the top. Mm. But actually for many women in the legal profession, it's a sticky floor issue rather than a glass ceiling issue. And that point I mentioned earlier about women dropping out of the bar, quite often it is after you've had a child, really high percentage, after you've had a second child. You know, Laura and I are both parents of multiple children and working in this field, and that's actually quite unusual. And I think there's really good advantages for our for the law and for our client base to have women with that kind of experience. And I find it really concerning that so many women have to drop out at that time because of just the difficulties with your caring responsibilities and a range of other things. So I think, as well as the glass ceiling, we need to think about sticky floor issues and how we address what's stopping women progressing up and what's causing women to drop out much earlier.
I think that's right. And I think, actually, this is a sort of gritty example, but I was a couple of years ago, I was doing a parole hearing and I had my period and I needed to take a tampon in and I needed to take medication in. And I didn't know how long I was going to be in there. And I had a panel of three men. And when I went through security, I asked to take my tampon in, and they were, first of all, they called security down. They called someone to do a special wand over the sealed tampons to make sure that I wasn't smuggling anything in. And then they point blank refused to allow me to take in painkillers. So I was expected to do a hearing that was going to last all day before three male judges with eight witnesses on my own, the only advocate doing all the client care for a learning disabled client and all the notes and all the advocacy myself, and not to have any painkillers to last me through the day. And I had to go before that panel, three judges, and at the beginning of the hearing say, you know, I may need us all to stop this hearing and rise so I can go back to the gate to get pain relief because I have my period. I mean, why should a woman in 2018 or whatever it was then have to sort of say that? Why should I have to go through that? Why should I have to disrupt my client's case for that? And yet that sort of humiliation and difficulty is nothing compared to the everyday humiliation difficulty that my clients, my female clients in prison face in order to have to deal with their basic needs. You know, it's absolutely nothing. Yeah. It's just a one-off.
What's interesting, isn't it? So on that topic, Laura, as you know, myself and another very brilliant woman, Angela Patrick.
Also a chair, also a trustee of Legal Action Group.
There's a plug in there for Legal Action Group. And myself and Angela did some advice last year for the Independent Custody Visitors Association on women who have their periods in police custody. And one of the key issues, and it eventually got accepted after a lot of very good work by the ICVA, we did legal advice for them, and then it was raised in Parliament by Stella Creasy MP and others. But it was accepted that actually the policy they had wasn't good enough, because their position was that women had to proactively ask. So women had to proactively say, I'd like to have a hygiene pack. And quite often they had to do that to a male officer in circumstances which were embarrassing. Mm. And now the change is much more akin to what you have in a maternity ward, where there's an assumption that you have certain needs and there's a pack provided and things are available. And there's a recognition that, you know, that obviously means some women who don't need tampons get tampons. But that's much better than having a situation where women who need tampons have to put themselves through the humiliation of having to say it and ask for it, and quite often won't say it and won't ask for it, particularly very vulnerable women. And we had some really horrific examples. And this had been raised over years by the inspectorates. So if you look at the inspectorates of constabulary, over years they talked about a whole series of different police forces around the country who'd failed women. These very vulnerable women often have been left in these very degrading conditions, which really did amount to, you know, inhuman type treatment, certainly very degrading and in breach of their rights to privacy and dignity.
Even talking about tampons is still it's a difficult thing to do, actually. And I was talking to an academic who's doing some research on judicial attitudes, and she came across a case study of a judge who made a determination in care proceedings, and one of the rationale for deciding the mother was unfit to be a mother is that she had changed her tampon in front of her daughter, in front of her child. I don't know if it's a daughter or a son, but in front of a child. And even just a few weeks ago, I was having to threaten to judicially review or to challenge a prison because a female client of mine had, who was in hospital suffering a serious life-threatening condition, was having to change her tampon while being chained to a male officer. You know, one, you shouldn't still need a lawyer, but I think that just sort of gives you a sense, doesn't it, that women's bodies and are still such a big issue and such a block and a bar.
And actually on that, I think you know, Judith, I act in a lot of the cases about abortion rights from Northern Ireland with many women who've brought challenges, and I was in the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission case last year, and for those of you who don't know, there's essentially an almost total bar on abortion in Northern Ireland, even in cases of rape or incest, or in cases of fetal abnormality. And there is something very difficult, about, particularly in, say, the sexual violence cases. You know, and any of you in the room who've been pregnant will know that feeling of it being so all-consuming of your body, and, you know, you having heartburn or it being uncomfortable to move in certain ways, and you've got so many reminders, particularly as the pregnancy progresses, that you've got this pregnancy. And if you have a woman where the pregnancy results from a violation of their bodily integrity in the most horrific way, so you've got, you know, a 13-year-old who's pregnant as a result of rape, as just to take one of the examples from the cases, you've got a situation like that. The 13-year-old's body is going to be reminding her on a very regular basis about the violation which she endured. And there's now a recognition internationally that forcing continuation of pregnancy in those circumstances in itself is a continuation of the original violence. And the Supreme Court has recognised that in the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission case, but it took a case being taken by the Commission, led by the very brilliant Natalie Leaving QC, and then support from a whole range of women, including some women who decided to put their names forward and actually speak out, people like Sarah Ewart, who decided to support the challenge, and lots of nameless, faceless women who'd had this horrific experience about sexual violence. And they took the case to the court, to the Supreme Court. And you have a situation now where there's a power vacuum in Northern Ireland. The Supreme Court judgment, the substance of it isn't being implemented, and nothing's happening. We've had no government in Northern Ireland. We've got no action. We've now had repeated statements by international bodies like the Convention Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and a very clear finding from a majority of the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom that the situation in Northern Ireland is in clear violation of international human rights standards, and it's not changing. And the position now is that individual women like Sarah Ewart are having to come forward and take their cases to try to change the law. So women having to tell their stories, tell that very personal, detailed story about their bodies and what happened to them when they had this horrific experience. Her case was a fatal fetal abnormality case. I don't think it's a coincidence that we now have a fatal fetal abnormality case going through the courts, because I don't think you've got the same stigma that you have in rape and incest cases. There hasn't yet been a rape or incest survivor in Northern Ireland who's brought the same case. So we're a year on from the court making the decision that it did. Couldn't be clearer. The Women and Equalities Committee in the House of Commons saying the law's got to change, central government's got to do something about it, and we're left in a position where individual women have to put their head above the parapet and say, this happened to me, and they shouldn't have to tell their stories in that way.
They shouldn't have to fight.
No.
So, it's been rather pessimistic.
Oh, sorry.
Last question then. Looking forward, do women in the law have a brighter future, do you think?
Well, I think they've got to. I think we've got to make it so. I think it's really important. One of the reasons why, actually, with Legal Action Group, we're doing this story, which is called Equal to Everything, which is Brenda Hill's sort of motto. Her, you know, you can choose a sort of coat of arms, as it were, when you become a judge. Women are equal to everything, she says. And Judge Brenda in the Supreme Court is to create a different vision for the future, a vision where everybody sees law as something that is accessible and applicable to them, both in terms of complying with it and having a sense of the rule of law, but also in the sense that they can do it. And actually, I think if I were a mum as well as a lawyer, I think I would be really pessimistic. But I gave you that example from my daughter, who in fact had the idea for this book. It was her idea. I read her a children's storybook about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she read it. It's called I Descend, and it's a great book about the life and works of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she said, yeah, that's good, Mum, but why don't we have one? And that's why I wrote to Brenda Hill and said, how about it? And I think she said something like, as long as it's good, I'm happy to go along with it. And she has, and she's been really brilliant in helping us make it something that I hope everyone will enjoy. And I think that there is hope, because I think we have to put the effort in, and we have to set the story straight from the outset, and we have to bring our children up to expect it to be better.
So I agree, we've been a little pessimistic, Judith. a lot of the topics have taken us down that road, but I agree with Laura about hope and us needing to put the effort in. I think, first of all, when you look at the statistics in relation to female judges, things are changing, and they're changing fairly slowly, not at the glacial pace that perhaps some people predicted, but even in the last 3-4 years there have been real changes. And there has been something particularly lonely about running these women's rights cases, often in front of all male panels in the Supreme Court, all male panels in the Court of Appeal, where you're the only female advocate. You know, you're the advocate who sticks out like a sore thumb. And I have found in the last few years that that's changing. You know, I mean, it's changing in very obvious ways with the number of female justices that we now have in the Supreme Court, for example, or the number of really superb female appointments that we've got to the Court of Appeal. So it's changing in that way. But there are more women advocates. So that Northern Irish Human Rights Commission case that I mentioned earlier, we had 6 female advocates there, so 6 female silks who were advocates, all on what I would broadly term the side of right, 2 male advocates on the other side, that's all I'll say. But it is changing in that way. And I do also think there's such incredible young women coming through in the profession, and who are actually determined to say, this isn't right, and I'm not putting up with it. And that in itself is really brilliant. I think we both work with some really brilliant young women. The other thing, I'm always quite determined to turn something which may be a negative into a positive. And I think when you've got a situation where you have not the greatest advocate of women's rights in the position of arguably the most powerful man in the world, with Donald Trump in the White House, there is an opportunity there. Because actually, Donald Trump being in the White House has meant that there's been attention given to issues surrounding Roe and Wade and women's rights in a way which there otherwise would not have been. We may well have our own opportunity coming up very soon here, I'll put it that way. But I do think there's some opportunities, because actually when you have someone in a position of power who said quite offensive things about women, I think many of us know some of the things that, I'll say it, Boris Johnson has said about women, you know, has said about women wearing the burqa, looking like postboxes and so on. And I think some of those comments, if you've got someone in a position of power who said things like that, which rile people and make people concerned, I think we've got to turn that into an opportunity, because that gives us a platform to draw attention to issues which otherwise would be the stories that Amelia Gentleman and Frances Ryan have to work very hard to package in a way that people want to read. And I think that's certainly happened in the US. There's been a real new lease of life for women's rights organisations in the US because of Donald Trump being in power. So some of the challenges which we face, I think we need to turn into opportunities.
Yeah, a backlash.
Exactly.
I mean, there was a wonderful moment in the Howard League, we intervened in the case of Cole, which was the first direct discrimination case of women in the criminal justice system, went to the Supreme Court. a little while ago, and there was just this wonderful moment where it was just before Lady Black and Lady Arden joined the Supreme Court. So Brenda Hill was the only female judge. She was presiding. She was there in the horseshoe with all the male judges on either side. And it was about the lack of approved premises for women, which meant that women who needed to live, be released from prison and go to approved premises were much more likely to be hundreds of miles away from home compared to men who were more likely to be close to home. And I think it was Lord Justice Toulson said, well, I don't understand, because if a woman is from Reading and there's an approved premises in Reading, then she's near home and she's not discriminated against. And Brenda just sort of, we just watched her, she just gave him this elementary lesson in discrimination law and just said, well, just because an individual is not discriminated against, it doesn't mean discrimination doesn't exist. And she said, I'm, you know, sitting there as president of the Supreme Court, not discriminated against, but it doesn't mean it's not there. And of course, it was a great case, and it was the first finding of direct discrimination in that context. And I just think we're nearly there. We're on that journey. There's some really good positive examples. Mm. It's just got to become normal now, and we need to accelerate that process.
Mm. After that very powerful speech, I'm going to say something much less inspiring and not really smashing gender stereotypes. It's about knitting. But I'm not sure how many of you have seen that amazing tweet from Sue Montgomery, who's a city councillor in Montreal, Canadian lady. And during city council meetings, she noticed that men were speaking a lot more than women. And she does knitting to concentrate in meetings. So she started knitting in two colours, red for when men speak and green for when women speak. And the colour-coded result is, you will not be surprised to hear, huge swathe of red with some broken small patches of green with lots of interruptions. And it's a really striking visual indicator of some of the things we've been talking about. But the reason I wanted to raise that as a hope point rather than a negative point is I think a key strategy in identifying some of these problems, in tackling these problems, is identifying them in the first place. Mm-hmm. And actually the result of her knitting going viral has actually been that in the city council, men have been a bit more circumspect when they're speaking and have been a bit more conscious that they tended to interrupt. And it's a lot of men who didn't intend to do that, didn't realise they were doing it. You know, it's similar to the Obama White House. Mm. Some of the women in the Obama White House a number of years ago coming up with this strategy called amplification, where they noticed that a lot of the time a woman would say something in a meeting and then a man would say it a few minutes later and get lots of credit. Yes. So they took to saying, well, I don't know if you heard Laura's point. Laura said X. And then they tried to amplify Laura's point. And that was a strategy developed in the Obama White House, you know, because they felt in that environment women weren't getting heard. So I do think calling it out is so important. And actually the result of calling it out in Sue Montgomery's case has been, really interestingly, that a lot of men in that environment have started employing a lot of the tactics women have used for many years. Apologising before speaking, saying, I don't know if somebody else might have already made this point or might have something to say. And that's not a bad thing, because actually much of the time, like in that study we spoke about earlier, you see women tending to adopt more traditionally male patterns. And actually one of the good things is where in the Sue Montgomery case, you see men adopting more female patterns of speaking, because some of those techniques and recognising that other people have something to say, it's not just you. We don't always have to be last word, to use your nickname from childhood. But those things are good, you know, and actually a lot of the time we end up ditching them and trying to move towards some of the more macho space-taking up techniques. Yeah. And actually maybe we should be moving a little bit more towards some of those techniques which women have used
for centuries.
For years.
Yeah. No, I think that's really...
So, thank you both. I'm going to stop asking questions now and open it up to the floor. If anybody...